Rumpus time is over.
There's a new sheriff in town.
Luke's crazy.
Did you hear that, Brian?
Luke, we're gonna have company!
Brian! Bad guys of the galaxies, beware! The defender of the universe is here!
In order to form a more perfect union.
Luke! Brian!
Luke Bryan's!
One margarita, two margarita, three margarita shot.
Stop that! You're not going into a song while I'm here.
And now for something completely different.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Talking Heads.
Hello and welcome to Dueling Tangents this lovely Wednesday afternoon, May 31st. It's almost June already. I cannot believe how fast 2023 is going. Don't remind me. But we got a great show today. I got my friend, my boss, my mentor, Mr. Andre Walton, executive director of Our Wisconsin Revolution, joining us today. Andre, how are you doing this Wednesday afternoon?
Thanks for having me, Will. I'm doing great. I'm very happy it's June after a long winter. We deserve this precious weather, so we're going to cherish it while we have it. But yeah, thanks for having me on today.
It's sunny and 85 in my neck of the woods, so I cannot complain. I'm not going to take full credit for that because part of that is that, we're starting to finally reach that Wisconsin summer. But we got some fun news and notes for you today. We're going to talk a little bit about student loan debt cancellation and the provision in the Biden GOP deal, which could be catastrophic. Andre is here as my expert witness to testify to that. But I'm going to start with a little bit of local news, reading from a piece at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel from Todd Richmond of the Associated Press. Wisconsin legislators to consider bills tightening prohibitions on National Guard sex assaults. Lawmakers are set to consider a package of legislation that would tighten prohibition on sexual assault within the Wisconsin National Guard after a scathing federal report found commanders had been for years flouting federal requirements for handling complaints. A study committee made up of legislators, district attorneys, and military veterans began working on legislation last summer to tighten oversight of sexual assault complaints within the Wisconsin National Guard. The State Assembly's Military Affairs Committee was set to start the process towards floor votes with a public hearing on the bills Wednesday morning. Now, we have seen that the U.S. military has had a number of issues in this regard going back, 20, 30 years. Sexual misconduct has been a long standing problem. The Department of Defense received 8,942 reports of sexual assault in the fiscal year 2022 alone, which was up about 0.8% from the 8,866 reports it received in 2021 and 14% from the 7,816 reports tracked in 2020. This was according to the department's reports tracking sexual assault. I am not surprised, honestly, with the military's longstanding reputation of swiping these kind of issues under the rug. I do want to note that the probe began after U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin received complaints in 2018 from Wisconsin Air National Guard Master Sergeant Jay Ellis about high-ranking officers doing very little to address sexual harassment and assault complaints within the 115th Fighter Wing Security Squadron, dating all the way back to 2002. Now, Baldwin asked the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations to look into Ellis's allegations, and the National Guard Bureau's Office of Complex Investigations ultimately agreed to look into the matter, releasing its findings in December of 2019. This report found that commanders launched internal investigations rather than referring complaints to local police and the National Bureau. Surprise, surprise, Andre, right? We'll investigate ourselves. Oh, we found out that we've done nothing wrong. Where have I heard that before? And this is required by the Defense Department regulations. They skirted that and they used poorly trained investigators who sometimes falsely presented themselves as Bureau investigators, failing to track complaints or enter them into the Defense Department database, and did not note substantiated sexual offenses in offenders' evaluation records, according to the report. This just screams, do as I say, not as I do. The powers that be are going to do everything in their power to control the narrative, to dictate how this story hits the media and what the regular American civilians will hear and say about it. Do you have any thoughts, Andre?
I mean, it's a continuous problem of law enforcement and military of unaccountability. I mean, when it comes to those branches of government, there seems to be a very, very sacred place for the government to not hold them accountable, whether it's for killing innocent civilians or for committing war crimes or committing any type of illegal acts of any kind. It seems to be that there's a lack of accountability from our government. So it's not surprising, but I think the point that stands out to me is that, you know, they're the ones going to do the internal investigations, and surprise, surprise, they're probably going to not find any wrongdoing. And if they do find any wrongdoing, they'll probably cover it up or try to whitewash it to the point that it doesn't seem as bad as what it really is. So I'm not surprised by that. This is kind of a continuous thing that happens in the military. It happens in local law enforcement. And we've talked about it before. It's even happened in local Sheboygan Police Department with their sexual assault problem. So I'm not surprised by it, but I think the surprising part is that it's going to be an internal investigation, which I shouldn't be surprised about as well.
Mm-hmm. And it happens in real estate as well. You look at the building collapse in Davenport, Iowa over the weekend, right? Police have secured the area. They're not allowing family and friends who can see the building, who are offering to sign waivers stating they, you know, if they are hurt or injured, they understood the risks. They want to go in. They want to search for the people and pets that are still missing. And they have been told no. The building is planned for demolition, but obviously that shouldn't even be part of the equation if there are still missing individuals involved. And that's still a developing story. So I'm sure we'll touch on that either later in the week or getting into next week once more information is clear. But there's a lot of very, very questionable behind the scenes reporting that I'm seeing coming out of Iowa, particularly involvement with the mayor's family, that his father might have some financial investment in this building, that it was deemed safe less than 2 weeks ago before they went back now post-collapse and marked the building as having failed inspection. It screams cover up in every aspect, and it seems that we're seeing Capitol use their ability to control the narrative to cover up their faults and mistakes in every industry applicable. I mean, we saw it with the military right here. I will note as well in regards to the Wisconsin National Guard, their commander, Major General Donald Dunbar, resigned just as this report was released at Governor Tony Evers' request, quite literally hours before the report of the release to the media. In other words, I was going to skate by until this became a big story. Once it became a big story, we had to have a fall guy. And in this situation, we're going to, you know, force you to resign in order to save face. It's grotesque, but it's about accountability. You noted that, Andre. I think that we have a real lack of accountability in the United States. Nobody wants to be at fault for anything. You always want to push the blame onto somebody else. And whether or not that, you know, whether or not we're able to change that, it really comes down to local reporting. And I think that's the value of civic media and other boots on the ground journalists that are the ones that are asking these questions to people's face. So let's get to let's move on to our next topic of conversation, Andre. I want to touch briefly before we get into student loans in the main segment on the upcoming debt ceiling deal. Obviously, we touched on it briefly yesterday. I want to read from a piece from The Lever today. Debt deal gives fossil fuel lobby a legal shield. The Biden administration and congressional Republicans have slipped provisions into the proposed debt deal that would expedite construction of a controversial fossil fuel pipeline and attempt to block courts from hearing challenges to its legality, according to the text of the legislation. The language was inserted into the bill amid a flood of campaign cash from executives at NextEra Energy, one of the companies spearheading the pipeline, and they were throwing money at, guess who, Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Senator Joe Manchin. The bill not only mandates approval of a major gas pipeline, it also omits proposals to expedite construction of transmission lines that energy grid experts, say are necessary to transition the country off fossil fuels. The pipeline measure is part of the 99-page legislation that President Joe Biden's White House negotiated with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy to raise the debt ceiling and keep the country from defaulting on its payments. This package, which includes cuts to the IRS budget, the resumption of student loan payments that we'll touch on momentarily, and new work requirements for social safety net programs, is serving as a vehicle to push through the pipeline and energy permitting fast-tracking measures championed by Senator Joe Manchin and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Also included in the bill is a section requiring approval of the 300-mile Mountain Valley Pipeline, which environmental groups say would emit more than 26 coal plants worth of greenhouse gases amid a worsening climate crisis. Related provisions attempt to block judicial review of federal permits issued for the project, potentially killing off ongoing court cases that could slow or halt it and transfer any challenges to the legality of the maneuver itself to a more sympathetic federal appeals court. Holy moly, Andre. I mean, this shouldn't be surprising in the slightest. We have made no attempts to curb the upcoming climate emergency. And in fact, a lot of the ways the Biden administration has kind of bent the knee to coal barons such as Joe Manchin. Since the beginning of Biden's term, progressives have called out on the president and Congress to embrace the same tactic known as jurisdiction stripping to protect abortion and other civil rights from hostile federal courts. Instead, the White House is using the maneuver to try to help the natural gas industry complete yet another project that locks in new fossil fuel infrastructure, despite scientists' increasingly dire climate warnings. Does this come as any surprise to you, Andre?
No, it doesn't. But I think this is what I want the audience to really pay attention to. Political theater. The government is great at making you focus in on something that isn't the real true intention of what they're trying to do. So what was the conversation about when this debt ceiling argument started? It was all about what could happen if the U.S. defaults on its loans. And that was a conversation. Then people worry about the economy, what can happen to the U.S. If it defaults on its debts. All while that conversation was happening, the pipelines was getting put through, a provision on student loan debt was getting put through, food aid requirements were getting put through.
$85 billion increase to the military budget.
And again, that's why it was very important for the media to focus on what could happen if the U.S. defaults on its loans, because they didn't want the conversation to be on what they really wanted. And also the fact that Joe Biden could have used the 14th Amendment to avoid this whole political theater. So at the end of the day, it really wasn't a situation that even had to happen. We didn't even have to go into this process. But even before the conversation of the 14th Amendment came up, this situation could have been dealt with when the Democrats held the White House, the Senate, and Congress. So, I mean, there's Congress people. Yeah, Congress people are coming out right now and saying we should address this when we have full control of government, and then we wouldn't have this problem. So again, this is the conversation we continue to have, Will. It's controlled opposition. It's making it seem like you're opposed to something when you're actually not. So it's constantly a situation where
we're going to keep the tangent rolling after the break, Andre. We'll be right back. Give us a call, 844-967-2789. Welcome back, party people. This is Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian. And because you are fortunate enough to be here on Party Week, Will and Evan, and my special guest today, Mr. Andre Walton, Executive Director of Our Wisconsin Revolution, we are talking the debt ceiling bill right now. And Andre, you were on a bit of a roll before the break. I want to toss it back to you so you can finish your train of thought. Let's hear it.
Yeah. I'll actually change what I was talking about a little bit. But another point that I really want to point out is who was behind this. So this is very well known, and it was put out by the Lever News, is that the people who were pushing McCarthy and the right wing Republican Party to really go hard on this debt ceiling bill and add those provisions was the same think tank that was backing the loosening of child labor laws, which is fascinating to me, because what they're trying to do is loosen up the social safety net so that they can put more people back into work. Which
what was
is
this think tank, Andre?
That they didn't actually put the name of the think tank in the article, but they did say it's the same think tank that was backing the rolling back of child labor laws. Gotcha. Which is really concerning. So I'm definitely going to dig into that a little bit more. But another point that I want to make about this is that the Republican Party were making this about saving the U.S. money and making sure that we don't go into more debt, right? But if that was the case, why did you pass a $3.5 trillion tax cut to the rich? The actual savings that they will have on this, on making work requirements increase, will actually be minuscule to the $3.5 trillion. So it actually is not actually going to reach that goal that they're actually saying they're going for. If they really wanted to address the deficit and the debt, they would go reduce those tax cuts. But that's not what they want to do. It's really about, you know, giving back to the donors and making sure that they serve obviously the corporate interests and the business owners. So that's what it's really about. So that's really what I wanted to.
I think we got a couple examples, actually, Andre, of that. The most obvious is IRS funding, right? The IRS is one of the only institutions that can return more money to the U.S. government by investing more money in it. Their own. So the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office website, has a publication noting that a $1 increase in spending on the IRS's enforcement activity results in $5 to $9 in increased revenue, because every dollar you give the IRS gives them more teeth to go after the incredibly wealthy tax evaders that litter the United States, right? These individuals that are withholding billions and billions of dollars from U.S. tax revenue, we can go after them, but the IRS has to have the ability to. You have to fund them. Investing in the IRS nets positive returns for the U.S. government. So it's weird that the Republican elected officials would be attempting to, quote unquote, save money by cutting the IRS's budget, when in reality, that's one of the only entities on earth that will reward you with more revenue back by giving them more.
And you know what's spending. What's fascinating about that argument as well is because they say, oh, the Biden administration wants to hire more IRS agents to go after middle class and working poor. But actually, that's actually the reverse of what happens.
The exact opposite. Yeah.
When you have less agents, they actually go after poor people and middle class more because it's more affordable to go after them. When you have more agents, it's more easy for the IRS to go after rich people because they have more people and agents to go after. So it's actually the reverse effect. So it's one of those things like the reverse Robin Hood effect.
It takes a lot of money, resources, and people power to go after some of these ultra wealthy individuals who might have teams of some of the, you know, highest paid, most successful lawyers in the world working at their behest. You can't just send one young IRS staffer at them and attempt to be able to do that. The IRS just doesn't have the ability to keep up with that. So you're exactly right. It's manipulation of the narrative, because they're very well aware that the IRS brings more money in the more you invest into it. They're just able to turn the conversation on its head by suggesting that they want to have the ability or that want more manpower to attack, you know, poor and working class individuals, instead of being able to go after the true hordes of wealth, which is the incredibly wealthy tax evaders. I think another example, too, of the cutting funding to save money example that we saw is with the work requirements for people ages 49 to 54 now that are being implemented. There are reports coming out that the amount of people that will lose benefits that are in this age 49 to 54 range is less than the amount of veterans and children that have gained benefits, which also makes it a net financial negative. And I want to say that all of these people should be receiving government assistance. What is the role of a government if not to protect its citizens from the inherent problems of a capitalist system? But I think it's incredibly disingenuous of a lot of elected Republican officials to be harping on how important it is to save money, you know, how the Democrats are just wasting money. They're inefficient, blah, blah, blah. And they're cutting money in situations that's actually hurting the long term bottom line of the U.S. government.
Yeah. And one of the fascinating things when it comes to that is that it might actually cost more to implement this rule. For example, there's going to be more paperwork. People are going to have to do more applications.
Administrative costs,
yeah,
are
there's
going
to be more people you need to hire to process these applications. So it's actually not going to work very well in that part. But another aspect of this is majority of the people who actually get food benefits are actually working. So actually what you're doing is putting more of a strain on working people. It's a very small amount of people who actually do not work at all, who actually have food benefits. So actually it's not really helping. In fact, it's just making the bureaucracy more worse and actually making the paperwork increase as well. So it's another one of those situations where they're pretending to save, but actually in the long term, it's going to cost the U.S. government and local municipalities more money.
I think it's an attack on the poor because they know that that's what their voting base wants to hear. It reminds me of that famous clip of the Trump voter who said he's not going after the right people, right? We saw this in Wisconsin with the ballot referendum questions, right? They were already law, but Republicans wanted to throw them on the ballot to try to drive turnout for the upcoming Supreme Court race. So we're going to be right back after the break with our meat and potatoes conversation of the day, student debt provision in the upcoming debt ceiling bill. This is Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian, and because you're so lucky, Will, Evan, and Andre, see you right after the break.
One, two, three, four, one, two.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
Welcome back, party people. It's Wednesday, May 31st. This is Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian and Will and Evan celebrating party week. I'm so happy to have all of you party people with us today. I'm also happy to be joined by Executive Director of our Wisconsin Revolution, Andre Walton. Andre, we're talking the debt ceiling, and I do want to give one more quick comment, I guess, point of personal privilege before we jump into the student debt provision. I found a clip. Ev, if you could share the clip of Glenn Grothman, Wisconsin's 6th congressional district representative. We talked before the break a little bit about the war on the poor that it appears that a lot of elected Republican officials seem to be engaging in, a little bit deeper than just the culture war. They're going after the right people. They know that this does well with their base, and they've been trying to capitalize on the messaging. Listen to what Glenn Grothman had to say today.
But they left low-income housing untouched. I think as far as discouraging work and discouraging marriage, I think low-income housing is even a more dangerous program than the food stamps. So I'm including low-income housing in the mix of having work requirements. The amendment as drafted just includes Section 8 housing, which is an error on my part because there are other low-income housings as well. But that's what we have before us. I would appreciate it if you'd let that to the floor.
Gross. Absolutely gross. Quiet part out loud. They're not trying to hide it anymore, especially in a country that has such a massive, massive shortage of affordable housing right now. Where does Glenn expect these people to live? Where does he want, like, worker communities? Once again, Amazon can just build a neighborhood, force the employees to work all day, then come home and pay their rent right back to their boss. I just can't understand.
We're already getting there. Will
can hear that.
We're already getting there.
Yeah.
We have companies that have doctor's offices on campus, right? You're not even leaving mm-hmm. work to go to the doctor. I mean, we're getting mm-hmm. there.
And we know company towns are bound to fail. Why? Because that's been tried in the past. It was grotesque. It's your home is your most valuable asset for the vast majority of Americans. And it appears that this rent culture, rent-centric culture that has kind of taken over private equity, the Republican elected officials want to drive that throughout all of society. They want to prevent any low income housing. They want to, I'm not really sure what they're getting at here. If wages and full-time hours aren't increasing, I don't know how they expect working people to even afford their rent, let alone be able to purchase their own home. Andre, thoughts?
Again, not surprised, but let me tell you about an example that actually does housing the right way. So Vienna does it the right way. So they have beautiful public housing and everyone can basically apply and live in it except for the top 5% of society. And as a result, everybody has well adequate housing. There is no major homeless population in Vienna, and people love living in public housing. So it's fascinating that we continue to go the opposite route when there's proven ways of working out affordable housing. But Glenn Grothman clearly wants to go in the direction of endless homelessness, which I don't see how that benefits his thought of getting people more into work, because if you don't have a home, how are you going to apply for a job if you don't have an address? So that's fascinating to me.
I don't think he thought that far in the future.
Yeah, I don't think he thought that through. He's just kind of using his.
Keep in mind, he's been receiving a taxpayer-funded salary since 1993. He's 67 years old. So that's the vast majority of his life that U.S. taxpayers have been paying him. I also have to note that he's one of 49 Republicans who voted against Food Security for Veterans Act. So it doesn't appear to be just food stamps and other dangerous programs that are discouraging work and marriage. He seems to think anything that benefits the poor and working class Americans is just unacceptable. So before I feel terrible, Andre, we're going to push back the debt conversation one more second. I want to hit up Nick on line one. Nick from Madison, how you doing on this Wednesday afternoon, Nick?
I'm good. I have a good example in my own life. The last 6 months, I had to cut way back just to pay the bills, whatever. And I knew I'd be doing better in the future, and I'm doing better now. But I'm immediately now able to go out and spend some of my money around town. You know, go to a restaurant instead of getting a $7.99 pizza at Aldi. I had to quit donating to a lot of the good causes here in Madison. And I immediately am on the phone to donate to WORT after, you know, a year or so not being able to. So immediately, if you get a little break here and there, you know, it doesn't have to be much, then you can go out and spend your money for different businesses that need you to come out. So can't that be studied by an economist or somebody to show that it stimulates the economy to take it away from everybody? That's, you know, if they had a little more in their pocket, then they could spend, you know?
No, you're exactly right, Nick. Nail on the head. And the vast majority of Americans understand that. The ultra wealthy get ultra wealthy by hoarding their resources. Another $1,000, another $10,000, $100,000, to a person with billions in assets, it's just more zeros that they add to their bank account, right? But you give $1,000 to somebody in the working class, they're going to go out and spend that money. They're going to spend that money locally. They're going to put their kids into the rec department. They're going to go to a local restaurant, a mom and pop shop, to buy something from their house. That is the purpose of a capitalist economy, is that you have enough spare money for regular working class people to go out and spend it. The exchange of currency is how you keep these economies rolling. The vast majority of us understand that, but you can't underestimate the influence and power of those who own the vast majority of capital, as they don't want to relinquish any of the control they have over nearly every aspect of society. So, Andre, now it's your time to shine. I've been pushing it off for too long because it just makes my blood boil. But we're going to jump into the student debt provision in Biden GOP deal. It could be catastrophic, according to Common Dreams article. What if payments began and millions, literally millions of people default on their debt? What if seniors get their Social Security checks garnished en masse? How are we as an economy going to be able to handle the immediate necessity of billions and billions of dollars of student loan payments being clicked right back into action?
Yeah, this is very terrifying for me individually, because I have $39,000 in student debt. And I'm not going to say I've been living a high life, but it has made my life a little bit more comfortable now that the fact that the pause was continuing to go on. But let me read you the language. So the language says it prohibits the education secretary from using any authority to implement extension of the federal student loan debt repayment pause. So basically, if this is enacted, they would basically, the pause would be terminated 60 days after June 30th. And the reason why this is controversial is because no longer can the education secretary, along with President Biden, extend the pause. It would have to go through Congress. And we know that the Republican control, nothing's getting done in Congress, and there's absolutely nothing ever going to happen in the Senate. So basically what Biden did in this deal is he arbitrarily gave up the power to continue this pause. Now, why this is frustrating to me is because he can let this out of his hands. He can say, hey, if it were still in my hands, I would have extended it, but I have to go through Congress now.
It's accountability. So now we talked about it earlier. Accountability. Nobody wants to be held accountable.
So now he has an excuse not to continue the pause, even though he necessarily didn't want to in the first place, but he knew that public pressure was working toward against him, because a huge part of his base that got him elected was younger people, so people under 35.
That's something we should touch on, Andre. You and I know exactly. This as organizers. I have heard from so many young people. If it comes down to Biden versus Trump again, they will not vote for Joe Biden because Joe Biden told them he would get rid of their student debt, and he did not. Now, they're not saying they're going to vote for Trump. They have explicitly said, I won't vote for Trump either. What they have said is, I will stay home. And we have talked on Dueling Tangents for months and months and months now. Anybody who follows American politics knows this. When young people vote, we tend to have good electoral results. And a lot of the issues we're seeing around the country is that young people statistically don't vote. Why you would throw away a slam dunk like this is beyond me.
Again, and we actually, I'm glad the gentleman who just called on the phone just brought up that topic, because what is this going to do? One thing that we didn't take to account is when we had student loan payments going on, we didn't have this high inflation. So food didn't cost as much, rent wasn't as high, the cost of living wasn't as high. So now if you implement the repayments, people aren't going to have the money. So there is a huge risk of more defaults than previously. There's also the situation, the economy is going to stagnate. The fact that these people have had more money in their pockets mean, guess what? We were just talking about it. They were spending it. So they were going to the movies. They were going out to eat. They were going to, to
all
whatever
of the
they wanted to do.
Exactly. That they joke that millennials are killing.
Exactly.
We're able to stay
we were
afloat.
Spending money on those things. So what this is going to do is it's going to stagnate the economy. So there's going to be less houses being bought, less cars going to be bought. So everything that was going to basically, this was essentially the student debt pause was essentially a stimulus to the economy. Once this ends, that is gone. And we're going to see, and in my opinion, there may be more instances of unemployment. There's going to be more instances of homelessness. There's going to be more instances of student debt defaults. So it's actually going to be a ripple effect to a potential recession, in my opinion. So I think this is very short-sighted and I don't think Biden should have allowed this in his deal, because all of those things that I pointed out. So it's very concerning to me that this is going to potentially happen, but we do know that we actually don't know if they have the votes in Congress, because there potentially may be some opposition from not only the Democrats,
Andre, Pramila Jayapal has said earlier today she is officially a no vote on the debt deal, as well as AOC and Ro Khanna.
Also, the Freedom Caucus is railing against the bill. So we don't actually know if they have the votes. But if it does get through, this can be a major, major problem for student loan borrowers for a very, very long time. And there will probably more than 100% likely no extension to the pause. And then those repayments will start. And we can see a crap ton of defaults happen.
And to give the listeners a little bit of context to just how much money we're talking about, the financial firm Jefferies estimates that once federal student loan repayments begin, they will cost roughly 45 million borrowers a combined $18 billion per month, potentially having a significant impact on the broader U.S. economy, in addition to placing major strain on individuals and families. $18 billion per month that could have been spent in any industry imaginable is instead going to go back to these parasitic student loan organizations that have essentially preyed on the American myth that you need to have education or you're not able to, you know, advance in society, pull yourself up by the bootstraps or whatever. And the average federal student loan payment in the U.S. is around $400 per month. Think about what the average American could do with $400 per month. Like, I hate to make this joke, but the avocado toast industry is in a lot of trouble if millennials don't have their extra $400 per month. You know, the Starbuckses and all the stuff that older Americans love to rip on young people for not being able to afford, when in reality, it's this. It's our student loan payments. It's housing. It's the cost of rent, keeping a roof over your head, it's health insurance, it's all of these mandated spending every single month that I think a lot of older Americans kind of took for granted because they didn't have this massive financial burden that has been bestowed upon younger Americans. So this conversation is only just getting started. And Andre, I'm so glad to have you joining us today to cover it. We're going to continue after the break a little bit with the debt ceiling bill, but man, just hearing those numbers. $18 billion per month. Per month. $18 billion. Can you imagine? Each individual American, the average federal student loan payment of $400 per month. I can't. You give me $400 extra per month. Like I said, it's not just a couple extra zeros in some incredibly wealthy individual's bank account. This is money that's going right back to your community. This is money that's going to local restaurants. This is money that's going to local mom and pop shops. This is money that's going to entertainment, mini golf, going to see a movie. You listed a bunch of them, Andre. Going to events, purchasing tickets to, you know, a Brewers game or something that stimulates the local economy. Invaluable amounts of currency that is going to get thrown back into this cesspool of student loan repayment. So we're going to continue on this topic right after the break. This is Dueling Tangents with Luke and Brian and Will and Evan. If you got a tangent you'd like to share with us today, please throw it our way, 844-967-2789. Throw us some stories about student loan repayment yourself. I want to hear about it. This impacts everybody. We'll see you right after the break. Party people to Dueling Tangents. It is Wednesday, May 31st. I'm joined today by, of course, Evan Rock in the production booth and Andre Walton, the executive director of Our Wisconsin Revolution. Andre, we're talking student loan repayment in the debt ceiling bill. And I want to add kind of to something we touched on briefly before the break, but with a lot of, conservative elected officials and their attacking of the poor, I do want to note that House Speaker Kevin McCarthy attended California State University Bakersfield. Tuition and fees were inflation adjusted $1,982 when he attended. Today, millions and millions of Americans have double digit, very frequently in the tens of thousands of dollars, you noted yourself that you do, worth of student loan debt. Debt Collective, the nation's first debtors union, wrote on Twitter that this has huge and catastrophic financial implications for 50 million plus people, 50 million plus Americans that have serious student loan debt might now be forced back into the payment plan that could cost them on average about $400 per person that could be going into otherwise economically stimulating purchases. Andre, anything else you want to add before we move on to the next subject?
Yeah, I just want to add two things. So I just want to put the reminder out there that student loan debt is the only thing you cannot file bankruptcy for in America. So let's say a lot of former students start to default on their debts, it's still going to be with them. They can't file for bankruptcy. The second thing that Will pointed out is that the average payment for a student loan per month is $400 a month. Half of the country can't afford a $400 emergency. So how are they going to afford these renewing payments of student
$400 loans? Emergency every single month.
Exactly. So yeah, this is just very, very worrisome to me.
So we're going to jump to the call line. We got Tom from McFarland on line one. Tom, thanks for calling in to Dueling Tangents. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. And, you know, just to build more on the student loan, I encourage callers, if you have student loans, make sure you go to the student loan website because there are a variety of different payment plans that are available for you that can help lower those costs depending on what your circumstances are. And even if you're making a $5 payment, that counts as a payment. And, you know, within the student loans, once you get to X number of payments, and unfortunately for the average student loan, it's 20 years, but once you've made those payments, even if it's zero, even if it's five, that loan will be forgiven. If you're in the public service, make sure you're taking account those payments as well. Don't just sit there and say, well, I guess I'm stuck making this massive payment that I cannot afford. There are options, and I encourage students to explore those options and do what's best for them. Don't let the government tell you this is what you have to pay without figuring out for certain what it is that you have to pay.
Thanks, Tom. You always got to be as well informed as possible. Andre, any comments or concerns in regards?
Yeah, that is very true. You can have a certain payment and apply for income-based payment, But here's one of the major problems with that. It's called compound interest. If you're paying, let's say $20 a month or $40 a month, the interest on your loan is going to continue to increase. So a lot of time what happens in these loans is people are just paying off little parts of the interest, but while they're paying off small portions of the interest is actually growing. So what we're noticing with those type of payment plans is that people's loans are increasing. So they may be paying longer term. They might be paying instead of 40 years, they're paying 50 years or 60 years. So
are you seeing stories of someone who's paid $80,000 back on a $50,000 loan and they still owe $100,000?
Exactly. So yes, you have to be educated about these things, but be very, very careful about compound interest. That is why a lot of people will just settle for the $400 payment or whatever, because they don't want to continue to have compound interest. So it's a very serious problem, and you have to be educated about the compound interest part of it too.
You have to be vigilant. You have to be watching out for yourself, because nobody else is going to watch out for you. So, Andre, give me a little heads up for the last couple minutes of the show. What's Our Wisconsin Revolution working on? What you got coming up in the near future?
Yeah, Our Wisconsin Revolution, we're going to host a Medicare for All forum in Milwaukee. It's going to be at the Milwaukee Area Labor Council, Citizen Action of Wisconsin, Voces de la Frontera, United Electric, and also Wisconsin Poor People's Campaign has been officially endorsed this forum. And the purpose of this forum is to reignite the conversation around Medicare for All and get the real stories of people who are struggling with healthcare problems. We are the only industrialized nation that does not guarantee healthcare to all of its citizens. And as a result, we have medical bankruptcies, we have less efficient care, and we also have serious problems with, I'm losing the word, but yes, that is the point of the forum. So we want to reignite the conversation. We are also hosting, and the forum is going to be on June 24th from 1 to 3 p.m. We're also going to be hosting the Our Wisconsin Revolution State Convention. That is going to be on July 15th from 11 to 7 p.m. Details are still coming out, but if you're interested in coming, it's going to be in Madison. It's going to be at the MATC Truax campus. So definitely mark your calendars if you guys want to come hang with us, learn a little bit more about the organization, and talk about some advocacy work that we're working on.
Wonderful. Thanks, Andre. Brian from Madison's on line one. Brian, I want to get you in quick the last couple minutes in the show. How you doing on this Wednesday afternoon? What's going on?
Good, good. Just wanted to real quick on the student debt. I went to college because I was told I needed to, because that's what my entire generation was told, because these jobs require a 4-year degree now. That for absolutely no reason. It just requires it. No skills that you actually learned in college are going to help you do that job. And I'm on the graduated income-based repayment plan, but again, compounding interest. This is just a payment I get to make for the rest of my life. I will never be free of it. This is just a new way for rich folks to get the poor to tithe to them.
It's indentured servitude. You are forever stuck under their umbrella.
Yep, that was the thought. All right, have a good one.
Thanks so much, Brian. No, I agree. And there are thousands and thousands of stories, millions of stories across the United States of people just like Brian. I think a really important educational conversation that we will be having, spoiler alert, on Dueling Tangents either this week or in the next week, related to the education myth. Professor John Shelton, brilliant, brilliant professor from UW-Green Bay, is going to be on to talk about exactly what Brian just said, how we were kind of, as a generation, shepherded into college. You can't get a good job without going to college. You have to do it. And how that kind of allowed the cost of college to spiral and skyrocket, and then allowed those who were forced to take out loans to be trapped in this system of repayment that doesn't allow them any economic mobility. They can't spread their wings. They can't take risks. So we'll get to that in the coming days. There's so much to talk about in the state of Wisconsin. Andre, thanks for joining me today, this Wednesday afternoon. We had a lot of fun talking about student loan debt, even though it's not a very fun topic. It's very important, and I think all Wisconsinites need to be on top of this, because I guarantee you know someone who was directly impacted by this. We got a fabulous guest tomorrow. Professor Harvey Kay is going to be on to talk about the 21st Century Economic Bill of Rights. It's going to be a real fun show, folks. You're not going to want to miss it. Happy Wednesday, my third favorite Wednesday of the week. We will see you tomorrow on my second favorite Wednesday of the week. Take it easy, party people.
Have a good one, everyone.